Where do we go to get our reputation back? That's the question executives at independent publishing service provider Author Solutions are likely asking. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. A pair of lawsuits by authors alleging fraud in business practices at Author Solutions have recently ended, though doubts about the company will likely linger. Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, has more on the drama from this courtroom and others. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
Well, we always enjoy chatting with you about Friday. We get to hear about which courtrooms and which cases you've been following, as well as about the book business from time to time. So in this particular case, we've got a lot to get through. And let's start with the developments in that case that I previewed in the intro, which is multiple cases against provider Author Solutions. Things seem to have ended there. Tell us more.
Yeah, that's right. Now, you'll recall a few weeks ago, and our listeners will probably recall, that we first reported on that a settlement had been reached in the Author Solutions case in New York, and that the case was likely for all intents and purposes over, even though a second class action lawsuit accusing Author Solutions of fraud, much like the case in New York, was still live in the state of Indiana. Well, this week we learned that that case was dismissed as well. So all that is left now, I guess, is to pick up the pieces.
Right. Well, when you say pick up the pieces, it sounds like a mess. So for who is it a mess? Everybody involved?
It's a mess. I think you're right. That's a good characterization of things. I think it's safe to say that for everyone, the case against Author Solutions has been kind of a disaster. You know, for Author Solutions, I think it has exposed their company as, well, you know, something less than reputable. And I think it's probably going to be difficult for them to shed their image of, you know, being hucksters. This case may have failed in court, but I'm not sure. In fact, I don't think it has failed in the court of public opinion. And if you do a quick Google search on self-publishing and Author Solutions, you'll see what I mean. And with the self-publishing world only getting more competitive and there being more service providers in the game, I think it's going to be interesting to see how Author Solutions moves forward and how they recover here. For the plaintiffs, where to begin? I am sure the named authors who sued here are quite disillusioned. In fact, I've actually heard from one, so I know this to be true. And in the coming weeks, I'll be looking more closely at the case and specifically how the case was handled. To say the least, I don't think it was handled terribly well. And you can tell that by the fact that it was in trouble almost from the beginning in New York. There was a shifting array of plaintiffs and revised filings. And ultimately, as the suit was faltering in New York, a second suit was filed in Indiana where it should have been filed in the first place. And that move just sort of screamed desperation. I think all you really need to know about the end of this case, it accused Author Solutions of engaging in a fraudulent scheme. It made some pretty outlandish claims. Is that, at the end of it, Author Solutions CEO Andrew Phillips said he was very pleased with the outcome. And in the court's final order, it was noted that each side paid its own fees and costs. Now, as you mentioned, I spend a lot of time in courts. I cover the courts quite a bit, and we talk about the courts quite a bit on the show. So you probably don't need me to translate that last statement. Anytime you pay your own costs, it means you got hammered. So probably very bad for the plaintiffs here.
Anyone who's ever had a lawyer knows exactly what that feels like. Well, on to another case. And this is a place where they can afford as many lawyers as they want. And that's, of course, Apple. We talked briefly about them last week. And this week we've learned that they will, in fact, be filing an appeal with the Supreme Court.
That's right. Last week, we reported that the clock was ticking on Apple's bid for a Supreme Court review of its ebook price fixing liability verdict. And this week, a few developments on that score. Most prominently, Apple has filed for an extension to file its cert petition with the High Court. It's asking for 30 more days until October 28th to file that petition. And also, it's worth noting that that petition was filed by Seth Waxman, who some of our listeners may recognize. He is a former Solicitor General of the United States, and the Supreme Court is pretty much like his living room. So clearly, Apple has brought more firepower on board, as if they needed more, with Ted Boutros, who's also a very high-profile lawyer and has argued before the Supreme Court. But today, I posted a story on the PW site that asks, I think, the more important question, which is, now that Apple is going to appeal to the Supreme Court, will the High Court take Apple's case? And the answer is, well, it's no lock. Despite being a high-profile plaintiff and a high-profile case, the question is whether there's a real legal issue and whether that legal issue here is sufficient. And it's really not clear that there is a legal issue that would prompt the court to take the case. Now, a quick refresher, Apple argues that there is indeed a legal issue. Before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, that Judge Denise Coate made an error when she applied the per se rule to Apple's conduct. Now, the per se rule is a standard under which actions are so clearly outside the law, so clearly anti-competitive, that there's no examination of other market factors. Apple argues, and so did one dissenter on the Court of Appeals, Judge Dennis Jacobs, that case law mandates that Judge Denise Coate should have used the rule of reason because Apple, as a vertical customer of the publishers, can't be part of a horizontal conspiracy. At least that's what Judge Jacobs says. But I think that argument is a wee bit flimsy, if I may put my own lawyer hat here on, not being a lawyer. But I think it relies on some pretty willful ignorance, as called out by Judge Livingston in her majority opinion for the Second Circuit. Because in Apple's case, the per se standard did not apply to Apple's vertical contracts with the publishers. Instead, it applied to their role in organizing the publisher's cartel. And as Livingston notes and rebuts Jacobs at length in her opinion, it is clear that such actions, even by the Supreme Court standards, are deemed per se illegal. So stay tuned. We should know soon if we're going to have a Supreme Court case on our hands with Apple.
All right. Well, I'm glad we have you to follow it, Andrew, because it's a tough one for me. But here's a story from the courtroom that is a lot easier to follow and probably even for our listeners, a lot more fun to hear about. You have a story here from PW, a big decision in a fair use case, and this involves a dancing baby.
That's right. In a ruling that's being hailed by fair use advocates, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit this week affirmed that copyright holders must consider whether an unauthorized use of a copyrighted work may be protected by fair use before they seek to have it removed from online platforms like YouTube. Specifically, in a unanimous decision, a three-judge panel held that copyright holders have to make a good faith effort to consider fair use before they send a DMCA takedown notice. And those who do not make a good faith effort to look at fair use can be held liable for monetary damages. And this all came in a case called Lens versus Universal. And as you mentioned, our listeners will probably know it as the dancing baby case because it involved a 29-second clip of a baby that was dancing to Prince's Let's Go Crazy. And many of you will remember the home video. It went viral. It garnered millions of views on YouTube until Universal sent a takedown notice to YouTube claiming that the video infringed Prince's copyright. Now, the mother who shot the video, Stephanie Lenz, objected. And after some back and forth with YouTube and Universal, eventually the video was reinstated to YouTube. But that wasn't the end of the case because concerned the corporate copyright holders were routinely abusing the takedown provision of the DMCA and potentially chilling free speech online, the Electronic Frontier Foundation sued Universal for damages on Lens's behalf. And that baby in the video is a little bit older now and can probably explain the case to you. It's been 8 years since that suit was filed. And after 8 years of legal wrangling, the appeals court decision this week merely cleared the way for Lenz to take her case to trial. But the monetary damages, which are nominal and which she may or may not recover at trial, are not really the point, fair use advocates say. The court, in fact, made some very, very important distinctions for copyright law. For one, it squarely rejected Universal's claim that fair use can only be applied as an affirmative defense to infringement charges. And the court reiterated that fair use, in their words, is better viewed as a right. And the court was also unmoved by claims that having to consider fair use on such a large scale, I mean, we're talking about the internet here, would be simply too burdensome on copyright owners. But the court held that copyright owners cannot shirk their duty to consider fair use and that this imposes extra responsibility or responsibility, I should say, on copyright holders is not a reason for the court to reject it. So what's interesting to me about this case, and there are two things that really stand out. And the first is that most DMCA takedown notices are, in fact, computer generated. And in fact, I think the most fascinating part of this decision is that in there, the court expressly acknowledged that computer algorithms could could, in theory, make baseline fair use evaluations, and that would be a good faith consideration. The court wrote that such use of programs appears to be a valid and good faith middle ground for processing a plethora of content online while still meeting the requirement to somehow consider fair use. But I'll also note that this decision comes just weeks after the Authors Guild offered a radically different proposal for removing allegedly infringing content from the internet. Citing the ineffectiveness and the burdensome nature of the DMCA takedown procedure, the Authors Guild proposed that Congress replace it with a notice and takedown regime. And basically what that regime would entail is putting the burden on internet service providers to monitor and filter their networks for pirated works rather than putting the onus on copyright holders to consider fair use. It's a complete 180 from what the court says, but it's a very interesting development here because it appears to me that while copyright owners like the Authors Guild are pushing Congress one way, the courts are apparently pushing the other way. I think it sets up a great debate when we talk about copyright reform, which apparently is being considered by our government, though I think it's set to be passed on the same day my daughter gets her rainbow unicorn.
Well, she's been waiting for a while, but she may have to wait even longer. And you know, what's interesting about this is really that important change, at least in this court's opinion, about fair use, not as an affirmative defense, but really better viewed as a right. And that could change everything, and not just for YouTube. And I think the other part of it that we may turn to a frequent guest on Beyond the Book, James Grimmelman, to get his analysis on, is that fair use determinations could be made by a computer algorithm. That's a fascinating notion.
Yeah, actually, I was in contact with James this week, and he too agrees that that is probably the most fascinating part of this decision. And of course, you know, it may just be as simple as tweaking a current takedown algorithm to include some baseline fair use determinations. And some fair use determinations can be pretty simple. In the case of a book going online, for example, you can see whether it's a complete copy of a book or not. So that would be a baseline determination, I think, that would be acceptable for the court. But as James told me this week, it all depends on how the algorithm works.
Yeah, absolutely. It always depends. And 29 seconds, I suppose if you're Prince, that's 29 seconds too much. Well, you mentioned the Authors Guild there at the end, and we have a look ahead at what's coming up in the PW edition on Monday. The leadership of the Guild came in to meet you at PW and told you about some of their new plans.
That's right. You know, there's new leadership at the Authors Guild, and they're sort of retooling their policy work here a little bit and sort of tweaking their direction. And yes, the Guild officials did pay us a visit at PW to talk about where they're heading. You know, we had a story last week about the Guild's membership survey, but in Monday's edition, we'll have more with Guild Executive Director Mary Rasenberger and also Jan Constantine, their general counsel, and they're going to talk a little bit more about their fair contract initiative. For those of you who didn't see the membership study, it's on the PW site now. It's very interesting. It basically found, I'll give you the low light here, and that's that the medium income for Authors Guild members dropped from $10,500 in 2009 to $8,000 in 2014. That's a decline of 24%. Now, you know, the economy has been slow, but that's pretty precipitous. In an interview with Rasenberger and Jan Constantine, they talked a little bit about the Fair Contract Initiative and how that plays into the decline in author earnings, specifically about the lower ebook royalties. And, you know, they really spoke about feedback from members who really wanted the Guild to be more proactive in speaking up for authors. And I think the most interesting thing here is that Constantine told PW that it's really time to rethink publishing contracts. And I know we've talked about that on this show a couple of times, most recently, just a few weeks ago. And I couldn't agree more because, you know, contracts were written for a different world, as Constantine notes. And she's right. The digital publishing world, significantly different from the boilerplate contracts that are out there for the print publishing world. You know, we talk quite a bit about the Authors Guild on this show. And I think their decisions, as you might have guessed personally, not speaking for my employer, I think their decisions have been questionable in the past, to put it mildly, in a few cases. But you can read all about where the Guild hopes to head next in Monday's issue. And I'll just say that I'd wholeheartedly agree that authors, without question, really need an advocate in this digital age of publishing. And I hope the Guild can somehow limit how many windmills it tilts at in the coming years, now that we're a little further along in the digital age, and really begin to work effectively for writers. That would be a bonus.
Well, you know, Andrew, speaking of authors and speaking as one myself, I can tell you, we know a lot about windmills and tilting at them. So it may be something that comes with the territory. Andrew Albany, senior writer at Publishers Weekly, always enjoy chatting with you every Friday on Beyond the Book. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow us on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, beyondthebook.com. Our engineer and co-producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.